So would you like to enter Nirvana today? I should first warn you of what you just signed up for, because a lot of us think Nirvana is bliss or heaven, which it is, and actually what it really means, the word means, is blow out or extinguish. And so it's about blowing out or extinguishing the attachments of the ego, which allows us to move into the liberated state of Nirvana. So it means we need to do a little work to move the stuff that's in the way, right? And that's actually what it's all about. So, you know, in Buddhism, there's so much said about, you know, not getting into the grasping for what we want. So this is part of what the ego does, right? This isn't okay, so I want that, and I want that, and I want that, and I want that. And when we find what we want, it's the clinging to it, right? And don't let me lose this thing that I love so much now that I've worked so hard to get. Or it's the aversion, I don't want that, I don't want that, I don't want that. So this is sort of what the ego is always doing. Don't want that, want some of that. Don't want that, want some of that, you know? And so Buddhism helps us get into the presence, right? And in the present, all is well. In the present, we live in a sort of open-handed free space where things that come and things go and things happen, and there can be a joy and delight in those things, as well as it's okay, you know? Life is impermanent. Things happen that are temporal. So there's also a misnomer often then that because of that kind of open-handed, accepted way of living, that there's a dispassion in Buddhism, or that the detachment makes us sort of, you know, pull away from the joy of life. But if you've ever met Buddhist monks who are really, deep into their practice, such as like the Dalai Lama, what you experience is so much joy, right? So much compassion in that freedom. And so that's really the heart of Buddhism, is compassion. And that's where I really want to focus our talk today, is more on that aspect of Buddhism. You know, the Buddha said that Nirvana is our natural state, and anyone can reach it by practicing as he did. And his practice actually began with the idea of witnessing human suffering and therefore feeling compassion. The Buddha's name was Siddhartha Gautama, and he was born in 563 BC in India to a royal family. He was a prince right from the get-go. And so his parents brought in fortune tellers for this new baby to foretell of what would happen in his life. And the fortune teller said one of two things. He will either be a great king or he will be a great spiritual leader. Now, his parents were really wanting a great king for the land. And so they did everything they could to assure that would be his path. So big walls went up around the palace, and he was given all the worldly pleasures you could ever imagine a young child could ever need, or a person. Great food and beautiful clothing and lots to play with and gorgeous gardens, beauty everywhere, color everywhere, companionship. He was allowed to play whatever sports he wanted. He became a great warrior. And so, you know, he had beautiful women as a part of his companions. And so you would think, right, this young man would just be so thrilled with everything. And I guess he wasn't unhappy. He was 29 years old. He had gotten married and he had a child. And one day, on a rare occasion, he was outside of the palace and he had a vision of three different visions, actually, which changed the whole trajectory from king to spiritual leader. And the three visions were that he first saw with his physical eyes, a sick person. And he realized there was illness amongst humanity. And then later he saw somebody, an old man, who looked very decrepit. And he realized aging and old age was a part of the human experience. And then, actually, before he returned to the palace, he saw a corpse. And he realized that death was part of the human experience. And so once he was awakened to the pain of the human experience and felt moved by it, then that became his whole life. And he snuck out in the middle of the night and became a monk, renouncing everything. And then, as we many of us know, after many, many years of practice and teachings, he became enlightened under the Bodhi tree in deep meditation. And so it is meditation that is at the center of the practice, but you see what it opens us to is the soft heart, the open heart of compassion. And so this is such a key piece. Compassion, Merriam-Webster dictionary says, is the understanding of another's pain and the desire to mitigate that pain. And so that's a big piece of what compassion is. It can also be to mitigate our own pain, a recognition of our own pain. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. So you've met the key player, right? The Buddha, who was born 500 years before Jesus, even. And actually, he taught for 46 years. He didn't make his transition until he was 80. So he really had a long, robust time of teaching on the earth. Another key player in Buddhism is Kuan Yin. Anybody heard of Kuan Yin? Yeah, a lot of you have. So I have a statue here from my garden that I've had for a long time of Kuan Yin. But one of the things that really warms my heart, besides that she's this just amazing embodiment of human compassion, is this statue itself. When Grace, our goddaughter, lived with us in Santa Barbara, just at the ages when she was learning to walk and talk, every morning she would come out on the patio where Kuan Yin was standing, and she saw about eye to eye with her. And she'd say, very softly, "Hi, Kuan." And it just, got me every time, you know. So it is that you know, that love and compassion that continues. What Kuan Yin is a bodhisattva. And so this is her story. She first was, an earlier incarnation of Kuan Yin was a male in India in about the 12th century. And later she became popularized in China as Kuan Yin, the goddess. And she was incarnated as a woman who showed such great love and compassion for everyone, including to her very abusive father. She was very kind and compassionate and did amazing things for him as well. That when she got to the gates of paradise at the end of her life, she heard the cries of the earth below, the story goes, and she made a vow to return to earth until everyone could experience this liberation, this nirvana, this idea of the ego attachments falling away and the fullness of compassion and love that she was able to embody. And so a bodhisattva like Kuan Yin makes the vow to keep reincarnating, to keep returning to earth until every sentient being, which means every being that feels, including, they say, a blade of grass. So every blade of grass, in addition to humanity and everybody else, has reached that liberation as well. So it's going to be a lot of lives. We're pretty sure of that. Did you know that the Dalai Lama, the 14th Dalai Lama, who many of us know and love and who lives in Dharamsala, India now, is a bodhisattva? And he is actually considered in Tibetan Buddhism to be a reincarnation of Kuan Yin herself. And so we have a picture of the Dalai Lama if you've not seen him before, or in case you just want to enjoy his joyful countenance. One of the things I love about the Dalai Lama, besides the fact that he just sort of imbues compassion and joy and wisdom, is that he speaks in a way that is accessible to everybody. He says, if you want to make others happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, guess what he says? Practice compassion. It's that simple, right? Simple, not easy always, right? So this is a key tenet for us, is that getting to this happiness that many of us chase after, not grasping for it, right? Not being in the mode of grasping so much, but is through that practice, that the stillness of meditation practice, that we reach that heart, that then it becomes accessible to us. In Buddhism, there are four elements of immeasurable love, and one of them is, you guessed it, compassion, known as karuna in Pali or Sanskrit. And it means the resolve to liberate all creatures from their pain. There are the other three elements of immeasurable love are very related, so I'll just mention them here. One is metta, or loving kindness. You may have practiced metta, meditation, where you hold in your heart yourself and you say blessings to yourself. May I be happy, may I be at peace, may I, you know, these kinds of whatever it is that you wish to bless. And then you might bless somebody who's dear to you, and somebody who you maybe feel neutral about, like the checkout person at the grocery store. You might not know their name, but there's a familiarity. And then once your heart is open to all that compassion, where we started with ourselves, then we bring in somebody we're having difficulty with. And it's easier to practice that once we've sort of opened our hearts. So metta, loving kindness practice, comes out of this element of immeasurable love called the desire to bring happiness to all sentient beings. Another one is sympathetic joy, taking delight in each other's happiness. So when somebody has a great experience, we really feel the joy, can sincerely feel the joy with them. And the last element is even-mindedness, or equanimity, which is that ability to hold an impartial kind of status or significance or love for all people. It's got that even-mindedness that enables us to love all with equity, with a sense of equity. It's what we would often call, you know, raising up our love from that personal level of love to the universal level of love, where we can love all beings. So there's a story from a woman who was taught directly by the Buddha himself. Her name was Kissa Gotami. And Kissa came to the Buddha under great duress, in lots of pain, emotional pain and grief. She had lost her father, and then she had lost a friend, and then the unbearable loss that came to her was of her only child, her son. And he was a small boy. And she carried his lifeless body to the Buddha. And she was just overcome with so much grief and really pity for herself that she couldn't just see past it. You know, it was just a blur. And she brings him to Buddha, and she says, I can't, you have to bring him back to life. I have to have this one being in my life. You know, I've lost so much. And this is my son, my only child. And the Buddha says, I will help you, but this is what you need to do. You need to go to the houses of the villagers and gather up some mustard seed, and then bring it back to me, and then we'll go from there. And so the mustard seed was plentiful at the time, and he said, but before you go, one other thing. He said, you can only take mustard seed from a house that has not been touched by loss. So if the household has not experienced a death in the family, or, you know, in the household, or in somebody who was close to them, then you can receive the mustard seed. So as you can imagine, she goes to one house, knocks, she asks the woman is happy to help her, she runs to get the mustard seed, she's about to give it to Kissa, and Kissa says, oh wait, I need to know if you have experienced any death in this household. She, oh yes, you know, my aunt just died. She lived with us for a long time, and she tells the story, and she even begins to shed a tear. And Kissa says, I'm sorry, I can't receive the mustard seed, and moves on to the next house. You know, you can kind of see where this is headed, right? Gets to the third house. Actually, the person has lost a child themselves and begins to cry, and house after house, she goes all through the village, completely disheartened because she has no mustard seed, because there is no house that has not been touched by loss. So as she returns to the Buddha to tell him this, it begins to dawn on her that a human life includes loss. And this exactly, of course, is what the Buddha wanted her to see. And so with great ceremony and love and reverence, they bury her son together, and she joins him for the rest of her life as one of the devoted disciples of Buddhism. And so it is that knowing, that recognition in this story that is so important. And there's some real nuances or maybe obvious things in the story, I think, that are important to pull forward. That, you know, that what she began with was a sort of victim place of self-pity, you know, completely swallowed up in an inability to see beyond herself. And in time, our awakening, our true compassion allows us to begin to open that up, right? To begin to see that there is a shared experience, and in this case, this shared experience of loss. What's also really important is not to get into a game of comparison. Pain is pain. And so it's easy for us to disconnect or disassociate because we've decided somebody else's pain is greater than ours or somebody else's pain is lesser than ours. But you can see how this your pain is greater or lesser than mine doesn't really serve, because where we connect is the feeling of pain. I don't have to understand exactly what it feels like for your specific circumstances in order to have compassion, because I know what it feels like to be in pain. And I don't need to make a judgment about my pain is greater or lesser than yours. Remember Roosevelt said, comparison is the thief of joy? And so it is that the comparison game is just yet another ego game, another attachment that we get into of how things could be or should be, or we wish them to be, or we wish they not to be. And instead of all that, we just find the common ground. I know what it feels like to be in pain, right? Every human being knows that feeling. Now, in Buddhism, they talk a lot about suffering, but there is a difference. We all experience pain. If we are freed, our minds are freed from all the stories that we tell and all the things we add on to that, we don't have to have suffering on the pain, right? That is ultimately a choice. We can free ourselves of the suffering that happens, which is really what the Buddha points to in his teachings over and over again, is that the freeing of these attachments, the extinguishing of the ego attachments, is what allows us to open up to this heart of compassion and this truth that is within us. So instead of I know how you feel, our standpoint can be more like I know what it feels like to experience pain. And so that from there we can really be helpful to one another. The Dhammapada, which is scriptures in some of the scriptures of Buddhism, says, encountering those in need is not a burden, but a sweetness. It's a sweet opportunity to make connection with what is most dear and true and deep within us in the human walk. And yet, we can also, if it does feel like a burden, sometimes it feels like a burden because maybe we've been in overstretch mode, right? In overgive mode. Maybe we need ourselves a little compassion. Self-compassion is a really important part of this. You know, when the Buddha speaks of being one with everything, that includes ourselves, right? So when we talk about having compassion for all sentient beings, it means us too. And so having that ability to bring forth a little kindness and compassion for ourselves is absolutely essential on our walk. Karen Drucker sings that song, I Will Be Gentle With Myself. That becomes my go-to. If I'm feeling like I need to be refilled, I listen to that song. I will be gentle with myself. I will only go as fast as the slowest part of me feels safe to go. I will treat myself like a newborn baby child. It doesn't get any sweeter and kinder and compassionate than that, does it? And so that always brings me back into my heart and into that space of slowing it down and allowing myself to feel that compassion. There are a lot of great practitioners out there, Buddhist teachers like Tara Brach and Kristen Neff that teach about self-compassion. And one of the practices that Tara Brach teaches is to put your hand on your heart when you're needing a little compassion, and sometimes even just sort of rubbing, you know, your heart a little bit. It starts to center you there, and just it's like a very gentle, kind touch to yourself. And to begin to offer that comfort to yourself, then you can acknowledge, oh, this is suffering. So in a moment that you are suffering in the, you know, in traffic, when you are suffering because your coworker did that one more time, you know, or whatever it is that causes you to suffer, you know, just putting your hand on your heart, oh, this is suffering, you know. And it does include humor sometimes, that we can begin to laugh at ourselves and to break up some of that. And then we might say some words of encouragement to ourselves, like we would talk to a child, you know, darling, it's going to be okay. everything's all right, you know? It's, you know, things, this too shall pass, and yet I understand there is suffering right now. There is pain right now, you know? So that kind of practice can really help us ground and give ourselves a little time and a refill. Of course, there's nothing like spiritual practice itself, meditation and prayer in particular, that refill our cup, to take a few moments in the silence, to allow ourselves to be filled by inspiring words or songs or chants like the ones that we've experienced this morning that really put you in that place of openness to receive, to refill, to allow. And that practice that the Buddha taught of meditation is really key to ground ourselves, to allow ourselves to be grounded. In fact, Kuan Yin is always barefoot to represent the fact that she's grounded and she's humble. And so that she's always in that kind of space of groundedness and humility. And that can also bring us a sense of that peace of that, feeling the earth beneath our feet, feeling a sense of spiritual groundedness within ourselves. Without a practice, it makes it really hard to really give to a great level, because we give and give and give, and then we get exhausted. I watch my sister, who we sometimes call Saint Lisa, because she gives and gives and gives, but she doesn't have any mooring. She doesn't have any anchoring practice. She doesn't practice prayer and meditation and either one or any particular spiritual practices that I know of. And so there's no way of that refilling. You know, when she's come to Unity, she says, "What's everybody doing during the meditation time? Like, what are they thinking about? It's so quiet, you know." But she likes us. So my hope is always that she'll come back again and again and learn some ways to really help herself refill, because she gives and gives and gives. And you know, when we give and give and give, we can give from a caring space, but it's going to run out. But when we are tapped to the internal spring of divine love, divine compassion, of the essence of peace, we get filled over and over again. And so then we can just be part of that circulation in the world of kindness, of compassion, of joy, whatever it is that we want to share with each other. So giving and receiving, then, is a really important piece, isn't it? This, once we realize that everybody has needs, including ourselves, we can get into that symbiotic rhythm of giving and receiving, that natural wave of compassion. I can't think of a better Buddhist story to embody this than the one of the baby elephant and his mother, who was once this baby elephant who was a beautiful, shiny, white color with a coral face and coral feet. And so he had this unusual, striking look to him. And he had, they say, his trunk was like a silver cord. And he and his mother had this beautiful relationship where they would walk about, and she would take the tender leaves from the mango tree, and she would feed them to her son, and she would say, "First you, then me." She would feed him the sweet mangoes, and then she would feed herself. And when they lived near a lotus pool, and so they would go in the pool, and she would take the clear water, and she would give him the bath, and then she would bathe herself, and she'd say, "First you, then me." And then he would squirt some water at her, and they'd start playing, you know, back and forth, squirting water at each other. And then they would take a nap in the muck next to the lotus pool. In the afternoon, she would go and sit under the rose apple tree in the shade, and he would play with the other baby elephants. And so this is how they passed their days. And then, you know, as time went on, he became a very strong bull. He was the tallest and the biggest of all the bulls. And so he really stood out with his unique coloring and his strength and his size. And as he grew with those big, long tusks, his mother's tusks began to yellow and chip some. And in time, she became blind. And he was caring for his mother in this very tender way, except for one day while she was sitting under the rose apple tree in the afternoon and he was off with the other elephants playing in the forest, the king spotted him and said, "Oh, I'd love to have that elephant. I'd like to ride that beautiful elephant." So he captured him and brought him back to the palace. He treated him well. He gave him all these beautiful flowers and jewels and blankets and sweet plums and pure water. But the young baby elephant would have or the young bull would have nothing to do with it. He didn't want to eat or drink. And finally the king said, "What's the matter? I've given you everything." And he said, "But none of it matters to me, and I cannot eat or drink until my blind, aging mother has had something to eat or drink. All I can do is think about her." And the king said, "What kindness. I've never seen such compassion and kindness, not even in a human being." And so he let the elephant free. And the elephant went to the lotus pool where he found his mother laying in the muck next to the pool, very weakened by then. And he brought some of the cool water in his trunk, and he awakened her. She said, "Is it raining or is it my son returned?" And he said, I've been returned, mother. And he put some of the water on her face, and miraculously her eyes were healed and she could see again. And so as she began to weakly get up, he reached for the tender leaves of the mango and he fed her and he said, "First you, then me." And he took the sweet mangoes, "First you, then me." And he gave her another bath, "First you, then me." That's compassion. That full circle, that understanding that we are in this together. And it's that connection that matters. It's that heart-opening experience of compassion that matters most to us. So last week we talked about the love of Christianity. This week, the compassion of Buddhism. We know that Christianity doesn't have the corner on love, and Buddhism doesn't have the corner on compassion. But there is all of us together in all these faiths that we celebrate. You know, Karen Armstrong, the teacher and author, she brought together a council of conscience that included key leaders from Judaism, as well as Hinduism, Christianity, Buddhism, Confucianism, and so on. And together they made the Charter for Compassion. And so if you'd like to take the vow and sign the Charter for Compassion, you can go to charterforcompassion.org and be a part of that practice as well, that is very interfaith in its style. So the key here, I think, is that we can be a refuge for compassion. You know, in Buddhism, they often talk about taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha, in the Buddha's as the teacher, the teachings, and the community. And we can take refuge, we can be the refuge of compassion for others. And that's really what this is all about, is us becoming that ability, that becoming that centered and that strength and that open-hearted, to be that kind of refuge for each other. So let's close out knowing that together, that we can be this refuge. And when we say all sentient beings, let's not forget that includes us too. So let's say this together. I am a refuge of compassion for all sentient beings.